All right, good morning. It is a brisk morning today in D.C., day three of the DoD Advantage 2024. I have a very pleasant guest today, Ms. Skylar Moore, and it was kind of serendipitous, maybe a little bit serendipitous that you and I are talking here today, but thank you for joining me, being flexible. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on. Excited to be here.
Can you introduce yourself? Give us a 30-second rundown, who you are, where you work, where you sit in government.
Absolutely. So I'm Sky Moore. I'm Chief Technology Officer for U.S. Central Command. I've been in the role for about a year and a half now. Prior to that, was Chief Strategy Officer for the Unmanned and AI Task Force 5-9 out in NAVCENT. Prior to that, spent some time on the Hill in DoD and tech sector and elsewhere.
Yeah, year and a half. How's it going?
It's going well. I mean, we're busy. There's a lot of opportunity to test capabilities and to learn lessons live, and we're making the most of it.
Are you enjoying it?
I am. I'm learning a ton, and I really couldn't ask for a better group of folks from the command group, from the four-star commander all the way down to the action officers across the components. We just have an incredibly motivated group of folks who have a very diverse set of challenges that they're having to get after right now. And I mostly just feel very fortunate to be surrounded by intensely competent people all the time.
Yeah. Let's level set for people who might be listening. Can you explain a little bit what being the CTO for CENTCOM means and maybe like kind of what the responsibility of CENTCOM is?
Sure. I think that the chief fill-in-the-blank officer roles are somewhat new to the department and can look somewhat different depending on the maturity of the organization of what particular focus is. For mine, I have interpreted it and been executing on it in a particular way, which is advising, facilitating, and pathfinding. So my first role is to be an advisor to the commander, make sure that he has the information he needs to make strategic decisions about both technology and innovation and how we integrate both of those into the command. From a facilitating standpoint, a lot of the time, the command is already working on a lot of great things. The joint directorates have their own projects and data teams. The components have their own task forces that are working on technology and innovation. So I'm there really to put jetpacks on them, to find the resources they need, to send them the people with the right skill sets that they need, to build mechanisms that allow them to be successful. And then finally, pathfinding is when we find an area where we don't have a mechanism or a team that's working on it, and we need to find a way to test out and work through the friction points of bringing in a new partner, trying a new method, trying a new type of exercise. My team can essentially take that burden of friction off the rest of the command for the early stages before handing it off.
It's funny, or I was just reflecting as you were talking, because I feel like we've been circling each other for a bit.
Absolutely.
So you're definitely out there. You're doing things. I've heard your name multiple times. What's it been like, or how did you even land that role or move in that direction to being where you are now?
I was a bit of serendipity, not unlike this podcast. Yeah. I was out at Task Force 5-9 in Bahrain for the year of 2022. And as the task force was gaining its strength and starting to run, General Kurilla came into the seat at CENTCOM, and he is a passionate advocate for innovation and for technology integration. And so he went out and received briefings from Task Force 5-9 a couple of times. Right. And so I met him through those briefings. He then opened up the role of Chief Technology Officer, the first that's existed at CENTCOM, and I was fortunate enough to be picked for that.
Wow. And anything that surprised you moving into the role? Like maybe you had an expectation it would look or feel one way and you walked in and something blew your mind.
In many ways, it is. I expected the unexpected. I walked into the role understanding the role has never existed. We are in a new space where we work with technologies that may have existed for decades, or we're working on operational problem sets that have existed for decades. But in combination, that friction between solution and problem is actually quite new. So I walked in with the expectation that every single day was going to bring something new and unexpected. I think that the events that have happened in the last couple of months, I don't think any of us could have anticipated, starting with October 7th and what happened in Israel, and then escalating to the attacks on our own forces across Iraq and Syria, the attacks that are happening in the Red Sea. The level of activity is quite exceptional, and CENTCOM as a region just keeps you on your toes. I think that that was probably the piece that I couldn't have quite grasped because I, for the most part, was a technologist
right.
and I didn't have as much experience in the operational space. And it has been humbling and really, really important to get that perspective to understand that the operational environment, you can build your concepts, you can build your plans for how technology can and should work. But when rubber hits the road, the operational environment does not care about your plans and you have to be able to adjust quickly.
That's a welcome reminder. So even those of us who are not as close to it as you are, that like there is an urgency to what we're doing. So what's a big rock that you're tackling right now?
One in particular that's probably relevant to the folks at the summit is about computer vision and how to wring everything you possibly can out of it. Because for us, as has been publicly reported, we're doing a lot of hunting, particularly in Yemen, for threats that are shooting ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, rockets, one-way UASs at commercial vessels in the open sea. And we are talking about one of the most significant choke points in the world that is being constricted by the activities of the Houthis. And so looking for those threats and looking to get ahead of those threats and take them away is something that takes up a lot of the command's time. And computer vision has to be a part of that conversation. AI has to be a part of that conversation because the geographic area is too vast and the amount of data being sifted through is too much for humans to realistically be able to get through it in a timely manner. And so we've been looking a lot at computer vision. We have been working as a command with computer vision as long as I've been here. And in crisis and with focus, we are learning where computer vision models that we have access to do or do not meet the mail. There is certainly a lot of potential, but there is a lot of room for growth in that space for us.
What? I feel like I want to ask you how to help, but I mean, so you're likely already partnering with a ton of organizations, mine included, I'm assuming.
We absolutely are.
Yeah. What kinds of things are you finding are gaps or areas where you're looking to do some of that problem solving?
You know, I think that we have a lot of breadth and depth in the technical build of computer vision models. This is not something new for the department. We've been doing this for years. But what is new is building out an operational workflow around the sustainment and maintenance of models at a certain performance level. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is that, you know, our experience with models has taught us that it is not that you get handed a model and it works perfectly and then it continues to work perfectly for the duration of the time you work with it. You get handed a model and sometimes it's a couple of degrees off and you have to, as a user, give feedback that steers it back to north. And then over time, you have to continue steering it back to north. Models do not stay at a persistent level of performance over time. They drift inevitably. And so having a mechanism in place that allows for users to interact with models and give that feedback is not a process necessarily that I think we have down pat. We've treated model development as it's the tech community's problem. Well, the models are being built over there. When you guys are done, hand it over to us, and then we'll get the magic benefits of it, rather than treating it as an intellectual partnership where both parties are contributing and building towards a better model.
Mm. Are you finding ways to work toward a solution to that?
We're working through it right now. The past 2 weeks in particular, we've been trying to work through how many people would you need on a team to surge on a particular model? What category within a model would you need that team to be surging on to get the most benefits on that model's performance? What are the what's the sort of back end of it? What is the latency of the data that's getting to them in the first place? How do you reduce it to make sure that it's actually that the work that they're putting in is actually reaping results? We're working through it right now. We certainly don't have all the answers,
yeah.
But I think that at the very least, we have a very specific and urgent use case that will force prioritization.
Model monitoring, that was a kind of a major thing and theme in Dr. Martell's keynote as well as something of priority. Like, so hacking together quick solutions, like that's great for urgency, but if you want it to be long lasting, you have to get to the place you're talking about. And how do you do that? I'm wondering how do we do more to integrate the buyer community to the end user community, which is that's the community that desperately that feedback has to have a channel to get back to. From your perspective, any thoughts on that in general? Like, I know you're working it because you have an operational imperative to do it, but like systematically, we have to collectively like do better at what you're talking about. And I've had multiple guests especially on the more so on the industry side, because I think they just see it and feel it more as they're selling solutions and capabilities to us. And they're starting to understand, okay, there's different communities here that I have to pitch to, which is unfortunate in my opinion. But that's where we are. So any thoughts or comments from your seat?
My view on this is that you have to force or create events that make all of the right stakeholders come into the right same place and have skin in the game. So whether it is an exercise where everyone is going to be performing, evaluating, conducting their own activities, the guide exercises really, or the global information dominance experiment series is a good example of that, where it forces a moment, a deadline, a moment in time where everyone has to surge together and flip your cards and say, how'd you perform? How did the technology perform? What is the user feedback? How did the users feel that their actual operations were impacted by that? And having that steady drumbeat of deadlines forces not only consistent evaluation of capabilities, but also on-ramps for people to come on, to your point of creating more opportunity space for folks on the buying side to try out new capabilities that they might not have otherwise. But in addition to having that drumbeat, I think that having those moments in time where everyone comes together forces the conversations that we're describing, where a user will say, well, this just fundamentally didn't work. And the technologist will say, well, why is that? And the user might say, well, I think it's because of this. And then the technologist will pull the thread back and say, ah, wait, no, that actually wasn't why it was wrong. And if those two communities had not been seated side by side, the user might have walked away with an incorrect impression of what was going wrong. And the technologist may have simply been in the dark that anything had gone wrong at all. And so having them side by side to hear one another's perspective and course correct what their understanding of what went wrong or right is very important.
That's a forcing function. That's what I heard.
Yes.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm just kind of thinking back on times in my career where that wasn't planned, but it happened. And that's when kind of ideation and brainstorming and innovation started to happen, was like different communities actually coming together, and you create the space to have conversation you never would have had because of your circumstances or your situation. So I really like that.
And your community is interesting, because I think that the acquisition community is unfortunately sometimes left out because it's something that hypothetically happens separate. And the reality is that all of it is linked together. Every ripple effect includes another community that is coming out of the same impact point. And to the conversations that we're going to be having over the next couple of weeks, we definitely hope to bridge that gap, because we all feel the effects of one another's decisions and activities. And the closer that we can bring each other together to make those conversations happen, the better.
Well, I'm willing to own my baggage, because a lot of what you're describing, relationships are two ways. So sometimes the criticism of my community is that we're too much of a blocker to achieve whatever outcomes people are trying to drive to. And there's also kind of a feeling in my community where will we show up and I'm trying to get to relationships. Like, it really comes down to, is my community committed to building relationships where they believe there's value? And sometimes that means talking to people that you don't maybe aren't expected to talk to, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but there's a lot to be said when you have a learning mindset and you go out and you learn to make yourself better. And that's not the norm in my community, was my point.
I think the learning mindset is exactly where my mind was going, which is that everybody's community, it's not that we need to make each other experts in each other's fields. It's not that I need to be an acquisition expert by the time I've finished speaking to you. It's not that I need to be a targeting expert by the time I finish talking to our joint fires element, or a modeling expert by the time I finish speaking to a computer vision modeling team. But we do need to be able to be aware of the questions we should be asking, or critical signposts that we need to be looking for as we interact with one another's like subject material.
Yeah.
And helping one another keep an eye out for that, while not expecting them to just have every single answer, would be a huge help. But it also, to your point, it's a two-way street. It's not just that you have to do all of the outreach and to teach the community about what acquisition questions they should be asking. We, on whatever side, have to be curious enough to come to you and say, I notice that I am running up against acquisition challenges in various forms. How do I
or
navigate
vice versa.
This space?
Even us asking, how can I help? Like, being open to whatever, without judgment, whatever the answer is, you know, and because that's how you going to the deep, dark places of maybe where you don't want to go is how you grow and learn in mm-hmm. general. And so as a collective, that just makes us better. That's just Bonnie's opinion there.
Totally agreed.
But there's always carryover into workspaces as well. So as an example, this, like, you showed up today. So we're going to apply some reciprocity here and figure out how we can help each other and see where the relationship grows into more of the topics and the problem solving that you were just describing. That's just a quick example.
Absolutely.
Where are you finding success in everything you described? We kind of touched on some big rocks, places where you're doing some problem solving. What's going well and what do you want to double down on?
Oddly, I don't know if I would have expected myself to say this a year and a half ago when I started, but I think CENTCOM is in a really good place in terms of culturally orienting itself to allow for more innovation and tech integration. And what I mean by that, yeah.
Tell me more.
It was something that I was ready, and the commander has always been clear that culture is at the core of everything that we do in this space. Innovation has to be in the air we breathe. It's not that one team, that one individual is quote unquote responsible for innovation. It's that an entire organization needs to believe in its bones that it should be looking for new and creative ways to solve its problems. And I actually think that we've made good progress there where the community feels empowered to do that, because I think that in order to foster a culture of innovation, I think it requires giving permission and giving tools. And the permission can only come from the highest levels. And General Kirilla has without question given that from the beginning. He not only gives permission, but expects it of you. He expects that when he walks into a room, you will already be thinking creatively about how to go about problem solving. We've then created mechanisms for people to be able to surface those ideas. We have events like Innovation Oasis, which is our Shark Tank style competition where folks can bring their good ideas, present in front of the commander, and have an opportunity for those ideas to take root across the command. But then also the tools. I mean, we're investing in additive manufacturing suites forward where people can come and see if they can solve problems that they have. We're investing in development environments at the command that we were just recently able to leverage for a hackathon 2 or 3 weeks ago. But giving people all of those pieces to bring together is something that we've spent a lot of time on for the last year and a half. And now in crisis, I think that we are able to see the benefits of it, because I see people brainstorming new ideas, whereas if we didn't have that culture, people might be afraid to bring them to the table. I see people leaning and reaching for tools that we've brought together, whether it's low-code, no-code tools, whether it's the full dev environment, whether it's hardware that we've invested in, that people feel that they have the opportunity to see whether their solution will work. And then I think that we have events that are just creating a constant drumbeat of opportunity to test those solutions and see whether it actually meets a problem, whether it's through our digital series, Digital Falcon Oasis, whether it's through the more monthly recurring events that we have through our components. I am encouraged by the breadth and enthusiasm of problem solving that I've seen, particularly since October 7th, that suggests to me that a culture of innovation has certainly been nurtured at the command.
That's amazing. That's really difficult, too. Congratulations to you and General Kirilla and seriously.
It takes a village, and it is that entire command group is just incredibly they are incredibly good at nurturing a culture of innovation. And candidly, when you initially asked me that question, it took me by surprise that was the first one that jumped to my head, because it is something that has been a focus and that we all acknowledged was going to be very difficult.
And you said a year ago that maybe was not the case.
a year ago, we were still figuring out how to even go about it. I think that we were figuring out what tools do people even need? What mechanisms of encouragement are most effective to make them feel that they can bring solutions to the table? And we've tried a lot. We've thrown a lot of stuff at the wall, and it does appear that at least some of it has stuck because we're reaping the benefits now.
If I could try to go a layer deeper on the people part of what you just said, because having your leader, of course, always makes it not just easier, but it drives incentives and motivations of everybody else. But how did he get the people under him to also believe and commit to kind of his value there?
I think it's a combination of just personality. He is a force of nature. If you have not met General Kurilla, for those listening who have, he has an energy that is really just contagious. It's really hard to not walk away from a conversation feeling energized and thinking that you will also want to think about new and different ways of problem solving. But also, I think walking the talk has been a huge part of it as well, both for him and for the command group, where in public forums, there will be live discussion about, is there another way of doing this? Well, we tried this and I'm not sure it quite worked, but let's talk about why it didn't work and have that candid feedback in public to show that it is useful and necessary and important to have those conversations out loud. And then, of course, he's empowered and invested in the tools and mechanisms that allow people to bring themselves forward. Events like Innovation Oasis or events like Digital Falcon Oasis could hypothetically take a back seat if in another scenario or another command with a different leader when we were at such a high operational tempo as we are right now. But he has made it very clear that it is a priority, and it's not just a priority because innovation is important, but it's a priority because it's a necessity for the command. Because we have no other choice. It's not that you have to make a choice between activities that promote innovation or operational imperatives that exist in the here and now. It's that both in combination, you can't do one without the other. So his emphasis on those two activities combined, his opening the door for people to even in crisis, take responsible risk to try out new solutions has...
That's amazing.
...led the command down a particular pathway, I think.
Yeah. What? Oh, man. Where do I go from here? What's the difference between Innovation Oasis and Dragon's Lair? Or is there a difference? Is that just his flavor at SecCom of what he started at 18th Airborne Corps?
So one inspired the other. He started Dragon's Lair when he was at 18th Airborne Corps and then carried it to CENTCOM, where we labeled ours in Innovation Oasis. But 18th Airborne Corps is still running their Dragon's Lair.
Right.
And it's always exciting to see the solutions that come out of different folks' events and just to shake loose an organization like DoD, we have so many people with so many good ideas. And if you just give them the opportunity to stand on a platform and say them, it is incredible what people come up with.
No, I feel that really hard. I've talked to General Donahue about this, where he talked about when he was talking about Dragon's Lair in particular, just like you said, he's amazed at the creativity and whatnot. And I feel like I have to keep highlighting or foot stomping that point that the creative ideas are not in the Pentagon. Creative ideas are likely with soldiers who are living and breathing their missions, and we have to give them space to release or express those ideas. And I'm not saying they're all million-dollar ideas, but if we don't have those channels, and our system does not encourage or promote or make sure that when the idea comes and we can carry the idea to something that can be fielded or whatever, because it is going to give them a 10x improvement. That is so critical, I think.
Well, and even at the Pentagon, I'll maybe say something controversial. I think there are good ideas at the Pentagon, but it's for the problems where the users are closest to them. Like the acquisition community, if you asked someone out at forward operating base what the right next solution is for acquisition, they wouldn't necessarily know. But there are folks at the Pentagon who do play a critical role in all of this, where all of our processes link together. And frankly, I would love to see that for the Pentagon as well, of looking at business processes and saying, hey, for those of you who are closest to this, who are drowning in spreadsheets that are burning hours of your day that your human brain could be used doing something else, what solutions do you you have that would lift burden on you, on your coworkers, that would make this process more effective and efficient. I think that all teams could benefit from this type of activity.
Mm. What kinds of pro tips do you have for others who are listening in terms of, we've been talking a little bit about culture and innovation, learning mindset in particular. Like, do you listen to podcasts? Do you read books? Like, what are you into? What do you recommend for other people, whether it's in the space or just for your own personal growth?
Before coming into this role, I did a lot of reading about the history of technology and military technology in particular. Mm. And it did teach me that we make a lot of the same mistakes over and over again. Mm. Of not thinking about the user when we test certain technologies, of maybe making rash decisions without zooming out and thinking about what is the problem you are actually trying to solve instead of the symptom that you might see or feel right now. And so I have done a good amount of reading about the history of military technology and our investments and testing of it and where it has or hasn't worked. The difference in the way other countries go about that and the ways that their cultures impact the way that they think about technology adoption that might make them faster or slower than us, more effective, less effective than us. Historical examples and precedent are always something important that I lean on. And then I love having one-on-one conversations with people in this community that I admire and respect, you, of course, being one of them. When you look across, you know, Colonel Molly Salisbury at 513 is an incredible innovator. Jock Padgett over at 18th Airborne Corps. We have such an incredibly rich community of people who are themselves like really stunning case studies in how you innovate in an enormous organization. So to me, it's a little bit of looking for historical precedents and then looking for contemporaries who are trying to muscle their way through similar problems that I am.
Mm. All right. You get the last word. What do you want to leave government or industry? Like, what kinds of message do you want to leave us with, whether it's how to help you? What just a reminder, you know, that we're all here in this together? Like, what's on your heart?
Bring in the user. Ask questions. Bring in the user. We as a user community, I as a facilitator of the user community, commit that we will give productive, constructive feedback on tools. We are not here to slap. I worry sometimes that people think we're just going to slap down tools and you'll never get it out in front of them again. We are, as a command, really committed to thoughtful and constructive feedback so that we can collectively make progress together. What we need from industry, from technologists, from the rest of the community is reaching out to us and asking about what are the true most critical problems that you are trying to solve, mm-hmm. so that we can prioritize those first and that we can make sure that we are all speaking the same language, that we are all reading off the same sheet of music when talking about those problems. Because what I have discovered over the last year and a half is that the friction and the challenges when you put digital tools, hardware tools, out into the field, when you try to build some of these mechanisms, are never what you expect. Yeah. It's never what you thought it would be on paper. It's the operational environment will roll a lot of grenades at you, and they are never the ones that you expect. And so the more that the tech community, that the acquisition community reaches out and asks questions about what the user's experience is, the better.
Well, there you have it. We're all in this together. We can't do this without each other. Thank you so much. I really appreciated this. This was a great conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.